However painful Sarah's passing was for the Caseys, her estate eased the financial stress that the family had been under since the previous winter, when Leslie had lost heavily by investing in a wagon load of dark tobacco. The family lost everything of value they owned, and were forced to move to the big red brick house in Hopkinsville where Carrie had spent her girlhood. It was a cold day, late in December 1893, when the family packed their belongings and moved. But Edgar was determined not to stay in Hopkinsville. He found the sight of the town's crowded, muddy streets, teeming with strangers, frightening. Edgar returned to the country and took a job working for his Uncle Clint on what was called the old Anderson farm. Life was quiet on the farm, which was how Edgar liked it. The hours he spent alone in the fields also gave him time to think about a dream he had had many times since his parents moved to Hopkinsville. In his dream, he was walking through a wood composed of small, pyramid-shaped trees. A girl walked with him, clinging to his arm. Her face was veiled. They were happy, content, and in love. The ground sloped downward to a stream of clear water running over white sand. They crossed to the other side, where they met a male figure, who was bronze-skinned, nude except for a loincloth, and had wings at his feet and shoulders. He carried a rectangular piece of gold cloth. "Clasp your right hands," he told them. He laid the cloth over their clasped hands and said, "United, you may accomplish anything. Alone, you will do very little." Each time Edgar had this dream, he would ponder its meaning. For many years, he thought the veiled female represented the woman who would become his wife. Later, however, he would come to believe that the veiled woman was not a flesh-and-blood wife who would make his life complete, but rather a metaphor for his own psychic ability. The winged man was a messenger of the gods, directing him to make peace with this aspect of himself, if he was to accomplish anything. He had to truly unite with his psychic abilities if his life was to be worthwhile. In June 1894, Edgar Casey, now 17, did in fact act upon what he believed to be a message from above. He had just returned from lunch to a field where he had been mending a broken plow. As he knelt to continue to make repairs, he heard a humming. A sense of well-being came over him. Edgar recognized it. He was going to hear again the voice of the angel he had heard years ago in his bedroom. "Leave the farm," the voice said. "Go to your mother. Everything will be all right." Edgar did as the voice commanded. He drove his mules back to the house and led them into the pasture. Then he went inside and informed his uncle that he was leaving for Hopkinsville immediately. His uncle protested, but to no avail. Like his father, Edgar was giving up farming for good. But that didn't mean he knew what he wanted to do with his life. The voice had directed him to Hopkinsville. It hadn't told him what to do when he got there. For a country boy who had probably never eaten in a restaurant, traveled by train, or journeyed beyond Christian County, Edgar found Hoptown alive with unusual sights and sounds. It had pistol-carrying country boys, scantily clad dance girls, gamblers in bowler hats and pinstriped suits, three funeral parlors, a store that sold just hats, a tea room, and a baseball field. None of these sights and sounds could match the delight Edgar felt when he first stepped off Main Street and into the Hopper bookstore one day in June 1894. It was the first bookstore he had visited, and inside he found everything he could imagine and more. Edgar spent much of the morning browsing around the store. Finally, he worked up the courage to ask Will Hopper, one of its owners, for a job. He was told that they didn't need any more employees than they already had. Disappointed, he left the bookstore and went across the street to speak with Charles Latham, who owned a dry goods store. Edgar had met Charles a few years earlier on a trip to town he had made on behalf of his father. Latham remembered Casey fondly and assured him that he would help him get a job once the young man made up his mind what he wanted to do. Edgar thanked him and told him he would stop back after he'd had a chance to look around at more of the shops. Next, he went to Hardwick's jewelry store. He asked the owner of this store for a job and, being turned down, walked up the street to Garner's drugstore and then on to Wall's clothing store. He next went across the street to the Bank of Hopkinsville, Hoosier's Tailor Shop, and three or four other stores before finding himself back out in front of the Hopper Brothers bookstore, which he decided would be the most interesting place to work. Inside, Edgar this time approached Harry Hopper, Will's older brother, who was now seated behind the cash register. Will had already spoken to Harry about Edgar, and was surprised to see him back in the store. Exhibiting a tenacity that bordered on arrogance, Edgar insisted that Hopper Brothers was where he wanted to work, and made them a deal that they couldn't refuse. He would work for nothing. If, after a month, they didn't value his help, he would leave. The Hopper Brothers agreed, and Edgar started work the following Monday. Edgar worked hard to acquaint himself with the books and to charm the customers. Harry and Will quickly came to appreciate Edgar. At the end of the first month, they bought him a new suit of clothes to replace his outdated and threadbare Sunday best. At the end of the second month, they gave him $10, which would become his monthly salary for the first year. He ended up staying at the store for 3 years in all. The bookstore offered Edgar the opportunity to meet people of his own age who, like the Hopper Brothers, knew nothing of his previous reputation. He especially liked the young college students who had so many varied interests and seemed so full of life. Edgar naturally tended to strike up conversations with people he recognized from church. In 1896, Edgar was given a Sunday school class to teach at the 9th Street Christian Church. He also took part in organizing the local chapter of Christian Endeavor, a worldwide interdenominational outreach program founded in the 1880s. Most memorable for Edgar during this time were the many interesting people he got to know and the entertaining events he was able to attend. Edgar spent one evening of note at the Holland Opera House, where he was invited onto the stage by a professional hypnotist, Stanley Hart, who billed himself as Hart the Laugh King. Hart invited members of the audience onto the stage, put them into a hypnotic trance, and ordered them to do embarrassing things such as play hopscotch, imitate fish, climb non-existent ladders, and sing silly show tunes. Edgar was invited on stage during a main performance, and Hart swore just by looking at him that he would make the ideal hypnotic subject. To everyone's disappointment, Hart was unable to put Edgar into a trance, and eventually Hart asked him to leave the stage. This was not, however, the last Edgar Casey would see of Hart. The hypnotist would later figure prominently in the discovery of the talent for which Edgar Casey became best known. Not long after he began at the bookstore, Edgar received an invitation to attend his first party, what was then called a moonlight. The party was to be held at a house just outside of town, which local residents called The Hill. The invitation was extended by Ethel Duke, a Hopkinsville elementary school teacher whom Edgar had known from Beverly. Edgar eagerly said he would come, though he later admitted that the thought of being in such high company made him feel, in his words, uncouth and uneducated. Leslie didn't share his son's enthusiasm at the prospect of him attending a party at the Hill. He forbade him to go. The reasons are not now known, but it is logical to believe that Leslie, being a conservative, didn't think it was proper for his son to attend a party in a home belonging to liberals, especially those who openly espoused such radical notions as a woman's right to vote and to hold public office. Edgar unhappily abided by his father's decision. However, this didn't keep him from finding out everything he could about life at that large gray house on the outskirts of town. The more Edgar learned about The Hill and its residents, the more disappointed he became at having missed the party. When Ethel came to the store to issue a second invitation, this time she brought along her best friend and second cousin, who, unbeknownst to Edgar, had been the one who had prompted the first invitation. It was not Ethel Duke who was interested in Edgar, but Gertrude Evans, the granddaughter of the family patriarch Samuel Salter. Ethel invited Edgar to come outside to meet Gertrude, who was seated in the back of Duke's buggy. Edgar was immediately impressed by Gertrude's beauty. She had just turned 15 and had silky brunette hair, large brown eyes, an oval face, porcelain white skin, and fine, delicate features. Edgar recognized Gertrude from visits she had made to the store to buy textbooks for her college classes, but they had never spoken before Ethel introduced them that day. Edgar was invited to attend another moonlight at Gertrude's grandfather's house on a Friday night at 8 o'clock. This time, he said nothing to his parents. He polished his shoes, oiled his hair, and set off for the hill on foot. Ethel Duke greeted him at the door and made introductions. By the time Edgar began to sort the family members out from the invited guests, he found himself face to face with Gertrude. Ethel Duke had quietly disappeared. Gertrude took his hand, and they walked down the carriage path, past the rose garden, to an open space between the trees, where she said they would have the best view of the moon. Edgar remembers not being able to take his eyes off of her long enough to look at the sky. She had a single red rose in her brunette hair. To him, the red rose epitomized the beauty that radiated from her, and in the years to come, he never planted a garden that didn't feature at least one rose bush. Soon, Edgar was going everywhere with Gertrude, parties, church socials, and performances at the Holland Opera House. Every Sunday after church, Edgar went to the hill, where he and Gertrude sat out on the large front porch, or joined others in playing games in the parlor, or reading out loud from books that he had brought from Hopper Brothers. All of the Salter family came to know about Edgar's ability to memorize books held to his head. Ethel Duke was his most enthusiastic fan, and Gertrude's Aunt Carrie couldn't stop questioning him about the things he said and did as a child. The fact that the family didn't seem to mind what they learned about him was reassuring, and subsequently Edgar revealed more about himself to the Salters than he had to his own family. He told them about his curious dreams, and how he could sometimes see colors or patterns of colors around people, when the person was feeling strong emotions. Edgar's stories captivated the ladies at the hill. Hugh and Lynn, Gertrude's brothers, tested Edgar with a deck of cards. He was reported to have correctly read the cards from front to back without turning them over. Edgar also helped them to find lost objects or items that they had hidden in the house. It seemed that he had only to go to sleep thinking about the location of a lost ring or a personal possession, and he would wake up in the morning knowing where it was. Edgar couldn't be quite sure of what Gertrude thought about the experiments that took place. She was quiet at the times when he and the others discussed the subject, and her eyes revealed nothing. Edgar knew, however, that there were times when she looked at him as if he was, he said, a strange fish that ought to be thrown back. He eventually asked her directly what she thought of his unusual abilities. Not one to mince her words, she responded, "I don't like it." Edgar said that he didn't like it either. After that, they seemed to get along better. On March 7, 1897, just days before his 20th birthday, Edgar Casey would propose to 17-year-old Gertrude Evans. Gertrude responded that she needed time to consider his proposal. 5 days later, she told him that she had decided to accept. Edgar was filled with joy. No sooner had they set a wedding date, however, than it had to be postponed because Edgar lost his job at the bookstore. Harry Hopper broke the news to Edgar at the end of that summer. He and his brother were taking on a partner at the store, and Edgar's services would no longer be needed. Edgar was astonished. He went next door to see Charles Latham, who immediately made him a sales clerk in his dry goods store. But that job only lasted through the beginning of the fall, and he was back out looking for another. He applied for other jobs without success. One day, as he was out job hunting, he happened to follow a large crowd into Richard's department store, which was having a sale. As Edgar told the story later, he was standing in the shoe department when a man asked him for a pair of shoes. Edgar sold him a pair, enjoyed making the sale, then looked around for another customer. It didn't take long before the department manager noticed. He asked Edgar his name, then told him to go to the bank and get some change for the cash register. Edgar worked through the rest of the day and then showed up for work the next morning. Asked why he had come to work without even applying for a job, Edgar explained, "Somebody asked me for something, and I just gave it to them." Edgar Casey would work at the department store for the next 12 months, but didn't take the same joy in the experience as he had at the bookstore. It was Gertrude's Aunt Carrie who finally told him he should strive to do more with his life. She suggested he look for a job in a city larger than Hopkinsville, in a position where he could better use his talents. In the summer of 1898, Edgar Casey decided to look for a job in Louisville, the largest city in the state, where he knew that there was a major wholesale book distribution and printing company. The John P. Morton Company had a catalog of books, publications, and other merchandise that was many times larger than the Hopper Brothers store. Edgar wrote to the distributor, only to receive a polite reply from the manager saying that his application had been received and would be put in a file until a position opened. However shy Edgar could sometimes be, he was also headstrong. He would not take no for an answer. Casey obtained letters of recommendation from everyone who did business at the Hopper Bookstore. He flooded the J.P. Morton Company's mailbox with such a stream of letters that after 3 days he received a telegram signed by the manager, Howard Griswold, ordering him to stop sending recommendations and report for work on August 1st. This gave Edgar 2 days to pack, say goodbye to Gertrude, and find a place to live. As much as Gertrude must have shared Edgar's excitement at the prospect of his new job, their parting must have been a bittersweet moment. Louisville was 180 miles away, and the 9-hour journey by train and the $2.59 fare would make weekend trips home for Edgar impossible. Nor would Gertrude be able to go to see him, for it would be unseemly for an unmarried young lady to visit a bachelor in another city, especially since they were engaged. On the advice of a family friend, Edgar rented a room at a boarding house on 2nd Street in Louisville. The owner of the house, who had once lived in Hopkinsville, went out of his way to make Edgar feel at home. He knew all of Edgar's family, asked about each one, then gave advice on how Edgar could quickly make new friends. Edgar began following his advice the next morning, when 11 o'clock services were convened at the Louisville First Christian Church. Much to his delight, Edgar discovered an old friend. Dr. Edward Lindsay Powell, the minister of the Louisville Church, had briefly been the minister at First Christian Church in Hopkinsville. Edgar introduced himself to Powell at the end of the first service. Powell remembered him from Hopkinsville and invited Edgar to join the minister's study class and to teach Sunday school. Dr. Powell also engaged Edgar in what has been described as one of the most active Christian Endeavor movements in Kentucky's history. It would be through his work with Powell and Christian Endeavor that Edgar would meet most of the important people in Louisville. Edgar's first morning at the J.P. Morton Company proved to be as interesting as his first church service. His fellow clerks at the store received him with great curiosity and interest, for never had someone come to the store with such glowing recommendations. Rather than put a damper on the already exaggerated expectations of his fellow employees, Edgar put on a performance that rivaled anything that they could imagine. He recited the entire fall catalog, every book, author, product, and price. The longer Edgar worked at the store, the more impressive his knowledge became. One day, Mr. Griswold assigned him to wait on a particularly important customer. In his journal, Edgar only refers to this woman as Margaret, but circumstantial evidence suggests that she may have been a grandchild or niece of James Phelps, a rich Louisville tobacco merchant. Margaret purchased several $100 worth of merchandise. Like so many others whom Edgar had waited on, she was impressed and curious at his astonishing knowledge of everything in the store. But this was not all that impressed Margaret. There was an artless, boyish quality about Edgar that endeared him to her. When it came time to pay, she handed him an embossed business card and asked him for his own, which he gratefully provided. The sales manager was thrilled when Edgar later processed the order. The client, he said, was the wealthiest girl in the city. The next afternoon, Edgar was called into Griswold's office and complimented for his efforts. Griswold himself had tried, unsuccessfully, for years, to entice Margaret's family into doing business with J.P. Morton. Edgar had not only landed their family's account, but made such a good impression that Edgar and John Morton received an invitation to Margaret's house for dinner that night. After the initial surprise at receiving the invitation had worn off, Edgar realized that he had nothing appropriate to wear. His single pair of shoes looked like they belonged to a farmer, not to a clerk in the wholesale distribution business. Griswold said that he would be pleased to arrange for a tailor to fit him for a new suit, and that he would send a carriage to pick Edgar up at his boarding house later that evening. In addition, Griswold gave him a raise. Edgar would now be making $10 a month. As promised, a carriage arrived and transported Edgar Casey, dressed in his new suit, to what turned out to be a palatial mansion in the most exclusive section of Louisville. Everything seemed unreal to Edgar, especially Margaret, his charming and beautiful hostess for the evening. His worst fear was that he would have nothing interesting to say to Margaret or her parents, and that what he did have to say would reveal him to be the simple farm boy he felt himself to be. But as it turned out, Margaret was part of the same Christian Endeavor organization that he had joined in Louisville. They knew many of the same people, and seemed to have much in common. After dinner, Edgar and Margaret strolled the house and grounds. A few weeks after this evening, Margaret's father footed the bill for a major building expansion and renovation of the store. Edgar was given an office of his own and another salary raise. Now he was earning the exorbitant sum of $40 a month. At no point in Edgar's memoirs does he admit to being in love with anyone other than Gertrude. In correspondence and in other writings, however, Edgar does mention a secret flame and acknowledges that the deep mutual friendship that began between him and Margaret threatened to end his engagement with Gertrude. Instinctively, Gertrude must have known that Edgar's promise of getting married as soon as he got settled in Louisville wasn't going according to plan. Perhaps she even knew something of his infatuation with another girl. Soon after Edgar began seeing Margaret, Gertrude dropped out of college, never to return, and took to her bed. Her already meager weight dropped precipitously. Her shoulders drooped, and lines formed at the corners of her eyes. Meanwhile, Edgar and Margaret spent nearly every Sunday together. The majority of their activities revolved around their work for Christian Endeavor, and at Sunday school, where Margaret was a pupil, and Edgar the teacher. Among the other interesting people Edgar encountered during this time was a hypnotist called Herman the Great, whom he met in the J.P. Morton showroom. Like many carny showmen of the time, Herman the Great performed card and sleight-of-hand tricks, as well as his hypnotist routines. He told Edgar that he thought the young clerk would make an ideal subject for hypnotism, and with permission from his manager, would put Edgar under. Edgar agreed to be hypnotized, but advised Herman that Hart, the Laugh King, had no success in putting him into a trance a few years earlier. Herman told Edgar something that Hart had also told him. The more often a person was hypnotized, the easier it became to put him under, and the deeper he went. Herman set about hypnotizing Edgar right there in the store. The next thing that Edgar remembered, he was lying on a countertop surrounded by fellow co-workers. Edgar, it seemed, had not only gone under, he had been the perfect subject and had done everything that the hypnotist told him to do. Edgar laughed about the experience and promptly forgot all about it. However, the incident took on significance later when Edgar would be hypnotized a second time. The second time occurred early the next year when Edgar accompanied his father, who was now working as a field agent for a life insurance company, on a business trip to Madisonville, Kentucky. They had been in Madisonville only a few hours when state health officials arrived at their hotel and ordered its doors closed. The hotel was being quarantined due to an outbreak of smallpox, and no one could come or go for 3 days. By coincidence, a fellow guest at the hotel was a hypnotist who volunteered to entertain fellow guests until the quarantine was lifted. Edgar was one of the guests who agreed to be hypnotized. Like Herman the Great, the hypnotist succeeded in putting Edgar into a trance. Again, Edgar had no memory of what had happened because he lost consciousness the moment the hypnotist put him under. Edgar knew only what Leslie and the other hotel guests told him when he woke up. According to them, the hypnotist suggested that Edgar play the piano. The hypnotist's intention was to amuse the fellow guests at Edgar's expense, but Edgar allegedly exhibited a skill far beyond what would normally be expected of a young man who had never had a piano lesson in his life. To much applause, Edgar sat down at the piano bench and began to play beautiful music. The hypnotist was greatly impressed, believing that he had helped the young man to discover a latent ability. The truth, however, was more astonishing than even the hypnotist could have imagined. For playing the piano skillfully was merely one of the many extraordinary latent talents possessed by Edgar Cayce. For the time being, Edgar didn't pursue the matter any further. Earning a living and making plans for his future were utmost on his mind. He could stay in Louisville, marry Margaret, and in all likelihood become an owner and manager of the J.P. Morton Company. Or he could return to Gertrude and face an uncertain future in Hopkinsville. The need for Edgar to make this decision reached a crisis by Christmas of 1899, when he returned home to Hopkinsville for the holidays. Edgar could see that Gertrude had become a mere shadow of her former self. Her skin was pale, and her weight had dropped to less than 70 pounds. The engagement ring he had purchased for her more than a year and a half ago was so large on her finger that he could easily slip it off and on. Both of their families interceded on Gertrude's behalf to help Edgar to remain true to his promise. Edgar's father, Leslie, offered him a job as a traveling insurance agent, and Gertrude's mother, Lizzie, promised them a place to live in the quaint cottage adjacent to the hill when they eventually married. It is interesting to speculate what may have happened had he decided to return to Louisville and not to remain in Hopkinsville after the holidays. In a dream Edgar would have while giving a trance reading in 1941, he was permitted to visit a great hall of records, which housed bound volumes of recorded events both past and future. The records not only told of what was, but what might have been. According to this dream, had he not married Gertrude Evans, she would have died of tuberculosis in 1906. Edgar himself would have died in 1914 from a debilitating stomach condition. No mention was made of what would have become of Margaret. As it was, Edgar and Gertrude celebrated the turn of the new century in one another's arms. Despite many trips back to Louisville in the days to come, Edgar would never see Margaret again. 23-year-old Edgar Cayce made a great insurance salesman when he put his mind to it. As his father's field representative for Woodman of the World, a company based in Omaha, Nebraska, he had total recall of prices and sales options, and could easily anticipate a potential customer's want or needs. The trouble for Edgar was keeping his mind on his business. From the beginning of January through March of the new year, he suffered from a series of migraines that prevented him from concentrating on his work or getting a full night's sleep. It wasn't until March 1914, when Edgar underwent surgery for appendicitis, that the cause for his headaches became known. As a result of the injury to his testicle as a child, a blood clot had begun to form in his pelvis. This had now hardened into a lesion, causing pain along his spine and his head when he was cold or under mental stress. During the winter of 1900, he was suffering from both. Unaware of the physiological reason for his headaches, Edgar blamed his condition on what he considered his own poor behavior over the past year and a half. He felt ashamed for not having been true to Gertrude. He also believed that he was not treating the angel of his childhood vision in the manner that was expected of him. He was now applying his God-given talents to selling life insurance. Equally disturbing to Edgar, his father had radically different ideas about the insurance business and the good that might come from their mutual endeavors. An avowed racist, his father took it as a matter of pride and honor that his policies were sold to whites only, and made this one of the principal selling points to his customers. To Edgar, the notion that only whites should have insurance was something that ran counter to his fundamental belief in equality and justice. Thus, to Edgar's mind, it was divine punishment that brought on his headaches, and destiny that resulted in the event that made it impossible for him to remain in his father's business for more than a few months. The incident that brought their partnership to an end occurred on April 18, 1900, when Edgar was on a business trip in Elkton, a small town about 20 miles east of Hopkinsville. He had stopped into a doctor's office for a sedative to relieve the pain from his headaches. The doctor gave him a white powder and told him to dissolve it in a glass of water. Edgar went back to his hotel and swallowed the drug. When he woke up, Edgar was lying in bed at his parents' home in Hopkinsville being treated by Dr. Jackson and his associate, Dr. A.C. Hill. The two physicians were quite concerned about their patient, for Edgar had been found wandering around the Elkton Railroad Station, acting strangely, quite like he had reportedly acted when he was hit in the spine by a baseball years before. The doctors didn't know how to treat him, except to put him to bed. They were pleasantly surprised when he woke up the next morning and seemed to be fine. There was only one problem. Edgar could only speak in a whisper. The doctors believed this was only a temporary condition, resulting from a shock to his system by the too strong sedative. Edgar was given a solution with which to gargle and told that his voice would soon improve. But days passed, then weeks, and eventually months, and Edgar's voice only seemed to get worse. Convinced that he would never be able to speak normally again, Edgar Casey believed his life was in ruins. He certainly couldn't sell insurance or return to his job at the J.P. Morton Company. William R. Bowles, a friend of the Hopper brothers, came to Edgar's temporary relief by giving him a job as an apprentice in one of Hopkinsville's only photo studios. The job didn't pay very much, but it did provide a modicum of income while requiring a minimum of communication. Edgar made a name for himself right from the start of his career. Although he would become known for his studio portraits, he also covered a number of local events, including Republican vice presidential candidate Theodore Roosevelt's arrival at the Union Tabernacle on October 13, 1900. Edgar photographed Roosevelt exiting his carriage. By this time, practically everyone in town knew about Edgar's condition. Friends urged Casey to consult Stanley Hart, the Laugh King, when he next visited Hopkinsville. Though Hart had once tried unsuccessfully to put Edgar into a trance, he was willing to try again. When he heard about Edgar's condition, he was certain he could effect a cure, and was undoubtedly pleased at the prospect of doing just that on stage in front of a paying audience. On the night of his first performance, Hart invited Edgar onto the stage. Hart stood in front of Edgar, telling him to concentrate on an object which he dangled in front of Edgar's eyes. Unlike Hart's previous attempt, Edgar slipped easily into a trance. There is no record of what words Edgar spoke, but from the moment he opened his mouth, the whisper was gone. The audience gasped, and then began to cheer. However, once Edgar was released from Hart's hypnotic suggestion, his voice returned to a faint whisper, despite Hart's instructions otherwise. Backstage after the performance, Hart explained what he thought had occurred. Edgar could not go past the third stage of hypnosis, and could therefore not take post-hypnotic suggestions. Hart concluded that the problem was not the power of his suggestions, but Edgar's inability to go deep enough into trance to effect the cure. Hart tried again, and again Edgar began to speak in a normal voice as soon as he was in a trance. But once Edgar woke up, he could speak only in a whisper. Frustrated, Hart boarded a train and continued his tour in other cities. Although he had failed to help Edgar, he had provided an important insight that would later be used to restore the young man's voice. Hypnotism did indeed have a strange and powerful effect upon Edgar Casey. Exactly what it was, Hart did not know. But he knew that his subject was capable of doing some extraordinary things while in a trance state. Hypnotizing Edgar seemed to bring out a power that was somehow related to his ability to read closed books in his sleep or locate lost objects. There was, of course, much talk at the Hill on the subject. A former professor of Gertrude's, Dr. William Giroux, had seen the demonstration at the Holland Opera House and became fascinated by the phenomenon. After discussions with Edgar and his family, Giroux sent newspaper clippings about Edgar, along with his personal observations about his case, to a doctor in New York, John D. Quackenboss, a leading practitioner of hypnotherapy. The eminent hypnotherapist arrived by train in Hopkinsville, determined to succeed where Hart had failed. But Quackenboss was no more successful than Hart had been. Hypnotized, Edgar could speak normally. Awake, he could only whisper. Unwilling to give up, Quackenboss decided to try a different kind of experiment. In trance, he asked Edgar to put himself to sleep for 24 hours. To everyone's surprise, Edgar took the suggestion quite literally. He went instantly to sleep and could not be awakened for exactly 24 hours, precisely to the minute. Though the experiment was viewed as another failure, Edgar was again without his voice when he woke up. Another important insight had been gained. While under trance, Edgar could and would do exactly what he was told. Like Hart before him, Quackenboss gave up and returned home. Giroux, however, was still intrigued. He studied Edgar intensively. The experiments had convinced him that hypnotism was still the solution to Edgar's problems, if only the right suggestions could be put to him. The problem, Giroux believed, was finding the right combination of suggestions. He enlisted the help of Al Lane, the only person he knew in Hopkinsville who had training in hypnotism. A middle-aged man suffering from chronic malnutrition, Lane had become interested in hypnotism and osteopathy as a means of improving his health. Like Hart, Lane was part of a groundswell of public interest in what today might be considered alternative medicine. Unlike Hart, however, he wasn't interested in the entertainment aspects of hypnotism. Lane viewed hypnotism as merely one aspect of a medical treatment that also included osteopathy, the science of manipulating or realigning human vertebrae and other bone structures to permit the body to heal itself, and homeopathy, a system of treatment based on the use of natural remedies that in minute doses produce symptoms similar to those of the disease being treated, thus triggering the body's own immune response. Although Lane called himself a doctor, in reality he had nothing but a correspondence degree. Throughout the month of February and the beginning of March 1901, Lane and Giroux had no trouble putting Edgar into a trance, at which time he would speak in a normal voice. But the results were the same as in the earlier experiments. As soon as Edgar came out of trance, the laryngitis returned. The only thing new about these experiments was that Edgar was more talkative in his trance state when Lane put him under than when previous hypnotists had worked with him. In addition to being able to make him do virtually anything Lane asked of him, Lane was reportedly able to have had long conversations with Edgar. Lane and Giroux put their findings into a letter to Quackenboss. In return correspondence, Quackenboss noted a similar tendency about Edgar, a willingness to do what he was told. At a certain point in putting Edgar under, there was a moment when Edgar's unconscious self seemed to take charge. Perhaps, Quackenboss suggested, Lane should put Edgar under and ask his unconscious self what he thought should be done to restore his voice. Lane decided to give it a try. He met with Leslie, Carey, and Edgar at the Casey home on Sunday, March 31st, 1901. The session started with Lane saying, "You are now asleep and will be able to tell us what we want to know. You have before you the body of Edgar Casey. Describe his condition and tell us what is wrong." Edgar began to mumble. Then his throat cleared and he spoke. "Yes, we can see the body. This body is unable to speak due to partial paralysis of the inferior muscles of the vocal cords, produced by nerve strain. This is a psychological condition producing a physical effect and may be removed by increasing the circulation to the affected parts by suggestion while in this unconscious condition. That is the only thing that will do it." Lane then commanded the sleeping Casey, "Increase the circulation to the affected parts." Edgar replied, "The circulation is beginning to increase." The upper portion of his chest, then throat, slowly turned pink. The pink deepened to rose, then to bright red. 20 minutes passed before he cleared his throat and spoke again. He said, "It's all right now. The vocal cords are perfectly normal now. Make the suggestion that the circulation return to normal and that, after that, the body awaken." Lane did as Casey instructed. Edgar woke up a few minutes later, sat up, reached for his handkerchief, coughed, and spat blood. "Hello," Edgar said in a clear voice. "Hey, I can talk," he grinned. Everyone in the room was quite moved by the experience. Edgar was elated. He wanted to be told over and over every detail of what had happened. Thus began and ended Casey's first documented trance reading. The door, as Casey's psychic ability would later be described, had opened. And once opened, it could not easily be closed. Edgar Casey's recovery was spectacular, but his cure was not yet complete. Approximately once a month for the next year, his voice would become a whisper, making further treatments by Lane necessary. During these treatments, it was only natural that more experimentation take place. "If you can do this for yourself," Lane said, "I don't see any reason why you can't do it for others." Lane became the first patient. He had a debilitating gastrointestinal condition that he had been suffering from for more than a decade. Edgar was skeptical that he could do anything about Lane's condition, but he was willing to try. Edgar went into trance exactly as he had done before, and answered questions about Lane as readily and easily as he had about himself. What astonished Lane the most was that Casey, in trance, spoke about his condition with the same confidence and knowledge as a physician who had studied this particular case for years. Also interesting was the fact that Casey would not be aware of anything he had said in trance until Lane told him afterward. Lane showed Edgar a detailed list of the stretching exercises and various medications that he had recommended. And indeed, this was apparently exactly what Lane needed. The symptoms of his illness vanished upon instituting the recommended treatment. It was not long before everyone in Hopkinsville was talking about how Edgar's voice had returned to normal and how Lane's stomach problems had been diagnosed and cured. A few brave souls, the majority of whom were personal friends, began to approach them for help. Florence Casey, a first cousin of Edgar's whose illness was described only as a woman's disease, was one of their first patients. Another was one of Edgar's future in-laws, William Salter, whom Edgar diagnosed as having a complex kidney disease. Both patients were reported to have been completely cured upon applying the treatments Casey recommended. Thus began an informal arrangement between Edgar Casey and Al Lane. Lane set up a small office in the upstairs of his wife's millinery shop, where he conducted all of the business and booked requests. Edgar stopped in once or twice a week to let Lane hypnotize him. A stenographer, Miss Addie Poole, was occasionally asked to join them to take down a written record of what transpired. Unfortunately, Miss Poole, unaware of the long-term value of the readings, destroyed them after she left Edgar's employ. All that exists are the recollections of those who were present. Lane conducted no scientific studies of what happened when Casey went into a trance, but through trial and error made some interesting observations. He discovered that the patients who received trance readings would not necessarily have to be in the same room, or even in the same county as Casey, for him to make a diagnosis. Casey, in trance, would only have to be told where a patient was at the time of the reading. Sometimes even this would not be necessary. In one much-discussed case, Casey would say that the patient he was being asked to diagnose hadn't gotten home yet, but had been delayed by talking to a friend, something that was later reported to be true. In another reading, he would say that the patient wasn't in the farmhouse where her husband said she would be. The husband, who was standing beside Lane while the reading was being conducted, interrupted Casey by saying, in effect, "She has to be around there somewhere." At this point in the reading, Casey hesitated, as if mentally searching for the man's wife, then said, "Yes, she's in the root cellar." Lane was of the belief that it was Edgar Cayce himself who was doing the diagnosing, or perhaps more accurately, Edgar's higher self. Later experiments would not entirely support this conclusion, but rather would suggest that Edgar's higher self was the conduit or channel for someone or something else. The source, as Lane began to call Edgar's higher self, used language that wasn't in Edgar's regular vocabulary and seemed to have its own distinctive personality. Given the fact that Lane was conducting upward of 10 or more trance readings a month, it is ironic how little direct knowledge Edgar himself had about them in his waking state. Lane conducted the majority of readings privately, and Edgar knew only what Lane took the time to tell him, which usually wasn't much. It can only be presumed from the records that this is how Edgar wanted it, for he clearly found the entire business of experimenting with the readings unpleasant. He admitted in his correspondence that he actually felt ashamed of them, feeling that they were not the occupation of a dignified person. He didn't mind an occasional experiment or two, but he disliked the kind of attention he was receiving. It was for this reason, and with Gertrude's blessing, that he took every opportunity he could to leave Hopkinsville, first as a traveling photographer for Bowles, then as a studio photographer in Bowling Green, where he would end up spending the next 8 years. This is the end of Side 2. Edgar Cayce, an American prophet, continues on the next tape, Side 3.